Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth with our 50 Greatest Concerts, Part 2.
Can't believe the news today. I can't close my eyes, make it go away. How long?
When U2 opens at U.S. Bank Stadium tonight, it may be one of the all-time great concerts those fans have ever seen. This summer, Rolling Stone came out with its list of the 50 best concerts. B.B. King, Jimi Hendrix, Elvis all showed up on that list. So last Friday, we considered what makes a superlative live music show with two huge music fans who also happen to be an English lit professor and a mayor. Today, we're bringing musicians into the mix. How have they been shaped by their concert experiences? What's it like to be on stage as a performer, giving your fans something extraordinary? Three musicians and your thoughts, too, on social media. What makes a concert experience sublime for you? Is it improvisation? Is it intimacy? Is it just seeing an idol in person? Tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our roundtablers today, Brother Ali is a hip-hop artist and activist. His new release is called All the Beauty in This Whole Life. Welcome, long time no see. Good to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
John Munson is a bassist and songwriter. He's best known for his work with Semisonic, Trip Shakespeare, and the New Standards. Boy, that's a long list, John. Welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And Cameron Kinghorn is here. He's the frontman of the funk ensemble Nookie Jones, out with a new self-titled album. Cameron, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Back to you, too, for a minute, because they're touring for the 30th anniversary of Joshua Tree. And John, because you said you'd seen them in a very small club in London, I think their challenge with this live performance and performing this album is to make this feel new and extraordinary in ways for fans who will remember the original and will inevitably be comparing the two.
That's not going to be a too tall of an order for them. I mean, I betcha they're going to love going back to that record because it was such a pivotal record in their career. And really, live musicians and great musicians, I think of any stripe, the gig is to get up and believe it just like you did the first day you ever did it.
Okay, you don't think that's a challenge? 30 years has gone by.
I don't think it's going to be a challenge for them. I honestly don't. They're just a great, great band. You referred to that show in London that I saw when they put out A Beautiful Day. We were in like a small club, probably a little smaller than First Avenue size club, and they'd been doing arena shows all over the world, you know, for years. And they got up on that stage in that small space, and they were projecting out with stadium-sized power in that club, and it was like everybody in the room was like pressed against the back wall. It was insane.
Oh, wow.
So I think they're old hands, and I saw them on the Sunday Bloody Sunday tour actually at Northrop, and they just put it all on the line. I mean, they are one of the great rock bands going.
So I'm struck by the word Cameron and Brother Ali that John used, which is get up and believe it. Is it conviction? Is that what you think about exceptional concerts and then your own performance, Cameron?
Yeah, I think if you don't believe it, like, there's no way they're going to believe it. You know, that's kind of like the first thing is really being there and being, present and just like believing in everything that you're doing up there. Because otherwise, like, it's much more difficult to capture an audience, I think.
Brother Ali, what's conviction mean?
Well, I think that there's got to be one of the convictions is to be open and to be vulnerable to the point where we're having an experience, because ultimately we're like the conductor of all of these hearts that are in the room. And so, you know, they're kind of focusing their attention on the men and women that are on the stage. And if those people and those hearts are open enough and vulnerable enough and honest enough to really have an experience and to really be in the moment. Because as performers, there are times when we're not in the moment and we lose touch with gratitude and we're judging this situation that we're in, and we're thinking critically about ourselves. We're thinking critically about this audience and this room and these monitors and this sound system and the microphone and how it might be sounding and all this other stuff. But when we let go of all of that and really are just in the moment and allow ourselves to have an experience, then everybody will have an experience along with us.
So when you said we, I wondered if you meant the audience or if you meant you and your fellow performers. I mean, can you be as open and as vulnerable as you want the audience to be?
I think that's kind of, as a performer, I think that's the task, or that's the opportunity. And sometimes it's really a challenge. Because if, you know, I think it would, imagine it would be similar to a yoga practice or any sort of art that really requires the heart to be really thoroughly present, that, you know, the times that we can allow ourselves to just completely embrace and accept and exist and be in love with that moment, you know, then that kind of opens up the space for the audience to do the same.
John, do you know when that's happening? Can you force that to happen?
I don't know about force. I mean, once you start kind of trying to force anything on stage, it tends to go sideways. If you there's a thinking, not thinking kind of flow state, that's the goal.
What's that like?
That's a difficult thing to say. I think anybody who's like picked up a pencil and kind of drifted off with into their mind and kind of just let the pencil wander, kind of maybe has some kind of understanding about it. I think it's a kind of being present. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Camera, you were nodding when John was talking about the flow state.
Yeah.
So some of this, not being a musical performer, I feel like you know you want to, there's things you have to hit and there's things you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be so present that you're not thinking about that. So
right. How
do you balance the flow state?
Right. Well, that can, I mean, like brother, like Ali was saying, it's like sometimes it is difficult because you're so concerned about other things that are happening in the room. So sometimes it can be really difficult to get to that place. But I think, like, especially, I think part of that, like, if you're in a band, part of that can come from, like, trust.
Mm-hmm.
And if you all believe, again, if you all believe in what you're doing and you all trust each other, it's a lot easier to get to that place. So if that isn't there, if that's not established, it can be really difficult, I think.
Do you guys think the audience can tell when you've hit a flow state and something exceptional is happening? Because the most professional musicians can make it, I would assume, look like that's happening.
I don't know. I've wondered that many, many times. It's very hard when you feel like you've had a very frustrating performance and somebody comes up to you and says, you just changed my life. You know what I mean? On some level, I mean, that's professionalism. I think there is a thing about if you practice, you know, what we're preaching here, maybe about trying to get to a place where you are really alive in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, you can get better at that, I guess, whether or not you force it is another thing, but you can get better than at that. And then it also tells you something about the goods. You know, if that song is meaningful and means a lot to that person, then seeing you deliver that song up for them, then that's going to have a transformative effect.
I mean, you guys are, Brother Ali and Cameron, you're touring right now with albums that you know, I would assume, inside and out. But you know that every audience that comes to an individual show wants not just, I don't think the audience wants precision. They want that being alive thing that John just talked about. So I'm curious about how you think about bringing that to the performance night after night after night.
Yeah. Well, there is an element, especially when your music is autobiographical, where you, and really all music, all art is autobiographical because there's some sort of living the process of creating that thing. So whether you're being very specific, like I tend to be about when I write songs, like then this happened and then I had this happen in my life and this is how I felt, and that sometimes there are specific letters to people in my life. But I think everybody's art is an experience that they had when they wrote that song or when they first heard that song and decided to start singing it or performing it. and the willingness to relive that every time you get on stage, and to have some sort of relationship with the song, some sort of relationship with the people, and to kind of get back to what we were saying about really showing up for it every day. I think it is really connected to a spiritual practice, like whether it's a meditative practice or a yoga practice or a martial arts practice, where you honor the actual mechanics of what you're doing, and you put so many hours in and you do it so many times, that you can really just be in that space. And you know, I've been taught by great, you know, like Sufi masters, who, there's one in particular who's from Syria, and he says that his father every day would get up, and or every week he would get up and he would perfume himself and he would put on his turban and he would prepare his lesson, and he would go in the great mosque in Damascus and sit at a certain pillar, and thousands of people would come and listen to him. And as years went on, and as the war got worse, as the civil war in Syria got worse, less and less people would come, to the point where there were no people. And but he would still get up every week and prepare his lesson and put on perfume and put on his turban and go and sit and literally give a lesson to nobody, to the point where his son said, "Why, nobody's coming." And he said it was never about them. He always believed that the Creator ultimately was giving people the experience that they were having, and that he showed up to perform his role in that. So it was never about the number of people that were there. And so, you know, getting back to that within the song is like, you know, many times we write these, those of us that write our songs or discover a song or have it gifted to us, we were in a room alone most of the time, or with a few really intimate companions when we make the song. And then somebody else was in a room alone or with their best friends, or had their iPod on or there's something like that. And then they discover a song, and we didn't know the song before we wrote it. We had no idea what we were going to do. A song is given to us, then it's given to somebody else, and then we all are brought to this room together. And then whether you're in the audience or on the stage, we all get to now have another experience with this song. So there's this really beautiful way that that all kind of feeds itself. And so I think there are just so many really beautiful kind of, in, to my mind, spiritual things that are happening and aligning to make those moments, you know, be what they are. And so if we're closed to them, or if we're worried too much about, like, I'm really fat today, or like my, you know what I'm saying? Like, for me, a lot of times I'm like, man, I'm really fat. Like, I should have really hit the treadmill harder before this tour.
You're thinking about this on stage?
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. There's definitely moments where I'm like, I'm really fat right now. You know what I mean? And like, I'm not breathing right and all this kind of stuff.
I guarantee you, we in the audience, we're not thinking that.
No, never. And
this
that's
just
that's
in your head.
Yeah. And you start realizing like these people are having their own experience.
Mm-hmm. You'd be amazed at the things that you can think when you're standing up there. Yeah. Not all of them good.
Yeah.
Cameron, you want to weigh in on that?
And I was going to say, just like, and like John was saying, like the number of times you'll have a performance and like maybe for yourself, you're thinking about all these other things.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, there's sometimes you'll be like playing in front of a certain crowd and it's like, okay, maybe this wasn't necessarily like their thing, but they all stayed and it seemed like they were into it, but you know, you're giving it your all, like all the way up to the very last thing, and then you get off stage and you're like, oh man, like I really hope they're digging that. And you got people coming up, they're like, man, like that was incredible. And you're like, oh cool,
something right. happened. Yeah, that maybe you weren't even aware of.
Yeah,
right. In
yeah.
the audience.
Yeah. But I think if you're willing to give, like give everything you got, like people are gonna notice that, you know. And it's, even if it's not, it might not be something that they would have ever heard otherwise, you know? But I think there is something about seeing somebody like just pouring out everything that they possibly have that you can't ignore, I think.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. This is part two of our 50 Best Concerts Roundtable series. Last week, we played a discussion about superlative live shows with two big music fans, and this week we've gathered musicians together to talk about what it's like to try to deliver performances like that and the concerts that have been meaningful to them that have influenced the way they are and who they are on stage. I want to hear from you on this. What makes a concert experience really sublime for you? Is it the improvisation? Is it the intimacy? Is it just having that experience in a room side by side with people. You can tweet me on that, at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, John Munson, bassist, songwriter, you know him. Cameron Kinghorn, frontman for the funk ensemble Nookie Jones, out with a new self-titled album. And Brother Ali is out with a new release called All the Beauty in This Whole Life. Cameron, I thought we would take one of your choices here for best and influential concert performance. Should we choose Emily King first?
Sure.
Would that be all right? Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about this show.
Yeah, so I saw Emily about a year ago. It was last September, I think. And she played a show at the Cedar, and it was her first time in Minneapolis. Which actually
pressure's really, on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that blew my mind because she's been doing it for a while, and I think it's cool that she decided to come. And I was introduced to her music through Jose James. She was on his album No Beginning, No End on a couple songs.
What was it about the show?
Yeah, so the for me, it was one of those, like, it was her first time in Minneapolis, so totally in a new market. And to see her, like, the stuff we were talking about was, like, as soon as she hit the stage for whatever, 90 minutes, every move that she made was, like, totally rehearsed, planned, and believable. Everything that I saw, it was really incredible. And it was one of those, like, you're watching the show, I was like, I had to take out my phone and start taking notes, you know?
Really?
Because I was like,
taking notes?
Yeah, like, I was like, I have to remember this, like, deeply, for sure. So
let's listen. Let's let it roll a little bit underneath us. So you're remembering that show now? What was she doing that was so exceptional?
Yeah, it was like the biggest thing for me was seeing like the way that she was moving with the music.
Uh-huh.
It was so cool. It was one of the cool, like really, it was like one of the coolest things I've seen. And like the way that she, so with my band, like we put on the suits, you know, we get out there and do that thing. And like seeing her come out in like the most hip like suit I've ever seen, coolest, freshest haircut, and she comes out and you're just like already wowed by that, and then just like every little thing in the music was like planned with how she was moving. That to me, that was like, wow, that's something special, like if you're taking that much time to do that.
So one of the things that I wanted to talk about was stage charisma, and I want to know how you guys, and it sounds like she had it. That's something that you were struck by. John, how do you know it when you're seeing it? Charisma, performance charisma, because some people don't have it, and they're still interesting to watch.
Man, that is really, I think a certain kind of freedom.
Really?
I think so, yeah. I think it has to do with a degree of comfort with oneself. And that's the kind of the freedom to be different, to be uniquely yourself. You know, I think those are the performers that I'm most captivated by. One of the artists that I wanted to talk about, except his music is too vulgar to actually play on the radio, is a guy by the name of Nick Cave.
Okay.
And I saw him when he first came to the Twin Cities in 1983. With his band, The Birthday Party, from Australia. And you could not take your eyes off of him. He was completely out of control. He was a very young man. He was probably 19 or something like that. And it was like watching someone lose their mind on stage. Kind of by the end of the show, he was just laying on the stage, and kind of crawling around and singing and dragging his mic stand around. It was nutty. I'd never seen anything like that before. I was quite a young man myself, and it wasn't any place that I wanted to go as an artist at all, necessarily, but I was like captivated.
Okay. So the thing that comes to mind with that description for me is, part of the reason that that was startling and exciting is you had never seen anybody do that kind of stuff on a stage before. Is that fair to say?
For sure. Yeah. But then I was going to say, He came back to the same club, played First Avenue again with his group Grinder Man, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, something like that. I don't know. Time has a funny way. It could have been 10 years ago, but I think it was within the last 5 years. And he was still utterly captivating. He was not on the bottle at all, but he was just a rock solid, powerful, in the moment performer with himself out there fully. And
without the crawling and
none of the crawling.
He didn't need
but just
it.
Like he was just, you know, he didn't need that anymore. He was just a great rock performance, unlike anything I'd ever seen. Again, you know, even having seen him all those years before, but at the moment that it was happening, it was like, wow, this is totally fresh and amazing. And that's charisma to me. I mean, and also a singular artist, you know, he had it, he has it.
You wave at the sky with wide, lovely eyes. Waves and waves of love, goodbye.
Brother Ali, performance charisma. People that you've seen where you're just immediately struck by their presence.
One of my mentors is obviously Slug from Atmosphere and one of my dear friends. And he has a way of being very captivated without doing much of anything. You know what I mean?
That is a gift.
Like literally he stands on stage and performs his songs. And I've had even some friends of mine who are like not the biggest Atmosphere fans. I'm like, just come and watch. And it's like, well, what does he do? I don't know. Just watch what he's doing. And it's interesting, too, because he'll have banter. Some of his banter, almost all of it starts as something that was spontaneous in the moment. And then if it works really well, it'll get added in and it'll start becoming part of the show every night. To the point where if you're on tour with him, it's like, oh, man, you're still saying this. But almost every night he'll say something new that'll happen in that moment, and it'll be one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
Okay, I think this comes back to the believing it. He believes it even when
He definitely believes it, but I think there's also a certain, like certain people are gifted with that and others just aren't. So you could find maybe a technically better rapper, something like that. But there was a time where we were in Lisbon, Portugal, and we were using CDJs at that time, which is like turntables that you could put a CD inside. So it was like taking one of the most delicate forms of technology and making it even more delicate.
Uh-huh.
So the CDJs broke. And so Ant, it was the three of us performing together. Ant had to go all the way to the back to the soundboard in this big outdoor festival where nobody spoke any English. And run the CD from the back. And so that probably took about 15 minutes, but we're on stage, on this main stage in a festival situation. And what are we going to do? And literally I watched Slug tell jokes in English to a non-English speaking audience. And they were so captivated and they laughed at the punchlines, even though they didn't really know. They just knew, like, they felt the tension build of the story and then he would hit the punchline. And everybody knew, like, it just released, you know. And so people would laugh and they would cheer. And it probably only lasted 6 minutes. But it felt like an hour of literally watching this person where nobody knows what are you doing. But he just really was that magical in that moment.
You know, I think we brought up precision a few minutes ago. Can a sublime, free-feeling concert also have a lot of precision to it, or do the two just not work together?
I feel like, one of those things is when they talk about like actors, they'll say you learn the script so that you can forget it, so that when you're saying it, you know, on camera or on stage, it really feels like this is your first time saying it. And I think that's what really, really great ones do, is that they know it so well and they know what they're doing so well. And they've seen these experiences before and things like that, that they, they almost kind of forget everything that they know. But then when it's time to do it, they know exactly what to do.
Cameron, how does that sound to you?
Yeah, I think that's it. And I was just thinking too, like thinking about precision. I think there's certain kinds of music, types of music, genres of music where probably like actual technical precision is more important to a point than others. where like you might have something where it's like, okay, this thing is really raw,
mm-hmm.
But you know, it wasn't perfect musically, but you know, maybe the show was precise, or like the feeling that was there was a precise feeling. And then you might go see like the orchestra, and you know, that stuff is, it's going to be perfect, you know?
I mean, that's a really good point. Go see an orchestra knowing that they've rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. So there's precision built into that.
Mm-hmm.
But the moments that are really exciting in an orchestra performance is when you feel like something's caught fire within the players themselves, right? And often I think that's not about precision, John.
I was picked up on something Cameron said there, that the idea of precision versus a precise feeling. I think that's a real difference. I think sometimes, you know, as Ali was talking about, the moment that you're gifted with something that is like magical, that's like when you have, it's the first time you've ever thought of it or heard it or put these various things together to create a feeling, and that's a precise feeling. That might not be a thing that anybody would ever want to see in a performance, but if you can make that kind of happen in the moment in an improvisatory way, that is a precise feeling, and people can pick up on that. I'm quite convinced of that, that people can pick up on that thing happening as a precise feeling, and it may not have anything like performance precision about it. It may be very ragged mm-hmm. in terms of the way it's presented, but it's a precise thing.
One of the other concert performances, John, that you chose was Run Westy Run. Talk about it.
Well, Run Westy Run is a Minneapolis rock band, and I think they're actually playing again now after many, many years of being dormant. And it was a bunch of brothers, the Johnson brothers, who grew up in South Minneapolis, and I think they were very influenced by the Stooges. And I grew up seeing them play in basements and stuff like that, which was really cool to hear them as they kind of cultivated their sound. And then when we all started playing out, they would just kind of come alive on stage in a way that very few bands do. And they just had like a wiggle and a shimmy to them. And, you know, Kirk had similar qualities actually to Nick Cave, in that he would just kind of lose it on stage in this way that he'd be like crawling around in the roof at the 7th Street entry, be like dancing up on top of the speaker stacks. And it was just great and fun.
Here's Run Westy Run. John, let's let it play for a little bit. Tell me what you hear in that.
I just hear all their swagger.
Yeah?
You know, they just were they're real in charge when they were out there. And they were having a big time. You know, they always had seemed to be having so much fun on stage, which that's a cool thing, you know, about it. If you can kind of see if people are, like, smiling and having fun on stage, you want to be a part of it, you know, as an audience member. It's like, those guys are having a ball. I want to be involved, you know. What can I do? I guess I'll dance, you know.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable that is part two of a series about the 50 best concerts. Rolling Stone put out a list. We thought it'd be fun to talk with musicians this week about how they're influenced by great performances and then what it's like to give a great performance for a room full of people. You can hear the last roundtable on this where we talked to music fans about it. That's on my podcast. Our roundtablers, Brother Ali, John Munson, and Cameron Kinghorn. We'll get a look at the latest news and we'll continue our conversation.
You're my, you're my, you're my, you're my, you're my.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable where we're considering great live performances. Rolling Stone put out a list of their 50 best concerts. I don't know, Elvis, Jimi Hendrix, B.B. King. We're asking musicians this week on the roundtable about the performances that were sublime for them and influential in some ways in their career. Cameron Kinghorn with us, John Munson, and Brother Ali. Cameron, this was one of your choices for a really special live performance.
Yes.
I love the way they sound.
Yes.
So yeah. Tell me about what you see on stage.
Yeah, so just quick, I've seen D'Angelo twice now, both times that he was at First Avenue.
Okay.
The first time was just he and Questlove. Yes. And so I'm...
I take it Brother Ali missed that show.
I missed it.
Oh, this, man.
That could be another show of like the great joints that you missed.
Yeah,
that could be a whole other conversation.
Right.
But everybody says that was one of the greatest things that's happened in the last 10 years in cities. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's good. D'Angelo was like one of my biggest influences. And so I saw he was playing at First Avenue. Obviously, right away, as soon as the tickets came out, boom, got him. Super excited about it. So I got there like 2 hours early. I was like the first person in line, you know, sitting there like, all right, well, maybe I was a little early. That's all right. And it was crazy because he has kind of a reputation for like, he might not show up and it's probably going to start really late. So they pushed back doors like an hour. And like, even like thinking about this all as like part of the performance, right? It's like push doors back like an hour. So then we finally get in and I'm standing right there at the front. And he didn't come out for another hour and a half or 2 hours. It was crazy. And the room, it was sold out, you know, the room is packed. People are waiting for like 2 hours. And as soon as he hits the stage, the place lost their minds. Everyone lost their minds. Like, who cares? I don't care that we've been sitting here for 2 hours. It doesn't matter. Everyone just like totally that went out the window. And then, you know, he didn't say a whole lot in the show. Questlove probably talked more. But like seeing him, his like ability... to capture people with just his music, you know, like he was sitting at the keyboard playing, comping himself, playing key bass, like the best key bass I've ever heard in my life, and singing. And it was just perfect. It was incredible. And it was all like the music that did it, you know? And so for me, that was like completely eye opening to see like, yeah, you can just sit down at a keyboard and it feels like there's an entire band up here on stage when it's just two people.
Wow. I mean, he doesn't need any pyrotechnics,
right?
Literally or figuratively, right?
Yeah.
It is
yeah.
enough for him and his instrument mm-hmm. and one other person.
Yeah. Or even if it had just been him, you know, it would have been the same thing, I feel like.
Do you think some of this is about he makes you wait, and that's part of the suspense and the gratification
right.
of the experience?
I'm sure that that's there. There is something about like the whole mystery of him, and like, you know, it's the fact that like everyone's talking in line like, oh, I hope he's here tonight, you know. And then you get in there and you're waiting, you're like, I hope he's here, you know.
Right.
Yeah, so I feel like that's probably something in there with that.
John, you were going to say?
I was going to say that D'Angelo's playing of Sometimes It Snows in April on The Tonight Show was like the most moving tribute to Prince. I don't think I've seen a performance like that on live television for a long, long time. He was obviously completely destroyed, you know, about the loss of Prince. And it was... deeply, deeply moving, and I think he's the kind of figure and the kind of artist who feeling flows through in a way that's really amazing.
One of the things I wanted to talk about that came up in our first part of the series was what it is like, what it means for the audience to stand shoulder to shoulder with people that you don't know and have something happen in a room that is kind of unexpected. I mean, this is the experience that I've had, you know, as a music fan. So this experience of being in a room side by side with people that you don't know and that you're experiencing something that you didn't quite expect, how much thought do you give to that? Brother Ellie?
I think it's everything. And I think that it really speaks to the power of beauty to communicate directly to the heart, to, in a lot of ways, bypass what's going on in the mind and in the ego and really speak directly to the heart and to the body in ways that are really universal, so that people, you know, because beauty on its own, just something being beautiful, communicates truth. And that's something that all of our spirits really respond to, I think. I think it's something that happens on a lot of different levels, because, you know, there are times where, you know, sometimes you'll go to like the performances and like cultural events of another community that you're not necessarily a part of. But, you know, so I'll be like, I'm experiencing this and this is really dope to me. These people are having they're also having this on another level as well. You know, there was a time when I was a kid and I was such a hip hop head, that I went to two shows back to back in Kalamazoo, Michigan. One was Ice Cube and he was doing the, Death Certificate tour. And then a week later I went to a Fishbone concert, both at the same theater. And the Ice Cube concert was right up my alley, because like that was music that we felt like was saving our lives in that moment and articulating all that pain and anger of like the 90s, the early 90s. But then Fishbone was this completely different thing. And like that was a world that I wasn't a part of at that time. And I was like, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. But I was watching these people, you know, lose themselves physically. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is or how to do that. But it really kind of showed me that, you know, when you're part of the community that makes that music, it's a really, really special thing. And feeling like you're being represented on stage in your own context is a special thing. But then when I went to the other one, to the Fishbone concert, you know, that I really still had an amazing experience, because of the fact that I think it communicated like directly past my brain, past my experiences, past my memories, and really just, you know, went right to the heart.
John, how aware are you that something within an audience of maybe people that have been drawn together at one of your shows from a lot of different life experiences and backgrounds is happening? I mean, do you give any thought to that as a performer? You care about that?
That's like the whole thing that you care about. I think with what Ali is saying, it's like that's the reason that you do it, is that you're hoping to bridge all those boundaries. You're hoping for everybody to have an experience that is like going to be something they remember for the rest of their lives. That's the drill, you know? I mean, that's what you're trying to do. If you're trying to do anything, if you're trying to force anything to happen, it's you're trying to make a beautiful thing that people can apprehend and be moved by.
Can the audience feel it when it's forced, do you think, Cameron?
Yeah, when it's forced, for sure, I think. It's that kind of thing I like. Like, it becomes uncomfortable, kind of, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like... Like, why is this happening? Why are we doing this right now? And then it's like, it kind of removes that, the whole thing we're talking about of like believing and like opening your heart to the whole thing. It's like, you don't, when you're forcing it, it's like, you don't believe it, you know?
And to me, when we use the term corny, like that's usually what we mean, is like, this is corny because this person is trying to manufacture something authentic. And a lot of times, like when you get a sense of like, he or she practiced this, and this is the one trick that they have. And so they're going to do this trick no matter what the situation is.
Right.
And they're trying to force me to believe. It's almost like the encore thing. Like this whole thing about where like the you leave stage as a performer and like you stand like 2 inches out of the view of the audience.
And we, the audience, always know you're coming back.
Yeah, but everybody so you know has that. To pretend that that's what's going to happen, you know, or
that
they're inventing us. Yeah. Or like, we're all inventing this thing that, you know what I mean? Yeah. So when things are corny, it's like, it just takes you out of the moment.
I take it Erykah Badu is never corny.
Never.
What's the performance of hers that really stands out for you?
I've seen a lot of them. But there was one where it's actually interesting, because I saw her once in Minneapolis, and I've seen her. I've been blessed to see her all over the world. Like, I've seen her in Europe and all kind of stuff. And this one particular show in Minneapolis, she performed with Cody Chestnut. Mm-hmm. And she brought him back on stage. And, I mean, she's always incredible because of the fact that she's got great songs. And she also is, you know, she's been in every situation imaginable. And also she's really in the moment. And also she's just a true artist through and through. And so anything that's happening, she always does the right thing. So you kind of think about it in terms of like tension building, and then she's able to do the thing that releases the tension and just makes it right again. So we watch her do this amazing show, and then she brings Cody Chestnut back on stage, and he goes into this like almost like Baptist preacher kind of like sermon, like mini sermon. There's all these big words, and he's referencing like conspiracy theories and different spiritual traditions and stuff like that. And then he finally kind of stops, and she's just kind of, it's very, very awkward. And she goes, yeah, and check this ish out. You know what I mean? But just like the way she said it was almost kind of like really harnessed, like what everybody was thinking, like, I have no idea what you just, what that, you know what I mean? And she, the way that she said it, so in such a like home kind of way,
right?
You know what I mean? With the curse word, right place. So she's also a comedian. You know what I mean? It's like you're just seeing a person that could really do anything in any moment, but she really captured the feeling of everybody and made what he did work. And then they performed this song together.
Tyrone?
No. Oh. They had a song that they did together, and it's just escaping my memory right now, but they had a song that they did together that really just tied the entire experience together. But, and again, we're there. So I was there with my wife at the time, who is watching, this is a black woman who's watching a black woman on stage be completely free, completely powerful, completely herself. It's like the one time that she gets to see herself on stage just be completely represented. So she's having experience. Then there are these two like white Minnesota girls standing next to us. And through talking to them throughout the show, I realized this is their first Erykah Badu show. And so they're witnessing something. You know, they're not having the exact same thing, but just because of how real this is and how amazing this is and how powerful this is, it's still completely communicating to them. And when we left, we ended up parking in the same area, and we left and we really had this amazing kind of experience, this like alchemy of spirits that happened.
You know, I was just thinking, I'm so happy that you two, that you all have mentioned women in concert, because Ann Powers at NPR has started this project to talk about 150 great albums that women have made. Mm. Because when you look at these lists and you look at the Rolling Stone list, most of those albums are made by men. Yep. But just naturally, you guys brought women into the conversation. Why do you think that we still kind of have this tendency to think of the big super groups who are mostly made up of men as the ones who bring it, who exemplify, you know, the best of this art? John?
Wow, you had to throw that to me.
I don't know. Thinking about it as I was saying it, I could tell.
That's a tough one. I mean, there's so many great women practitioners and women who have been incredibly influential to the form, but not as many as men. I don't know why that is. I mean, Aretha Franklin definitely is someone that comes to mind as like, just like trailblazing, totally definitive artist, who changed everything. But I don't know, you know, I mean, sometimes you think, is it just more men are in the industry and they're signing more men? I don't know. I don't know why that is.
Cameron, you have a thought?
I don't know. I feel like sometimes there's just not enough appreciation for what women are doing. You know, they're killing.
It's sexist. I mean, really, bottom line, that's just the true truth of it, right?
I think it is, too. We think about what it looks like to be a performer who gives that kind of concert, just the way we think about who should look like the president and other, you know, kind of stereotypes.
I think like in modernity is really a weird time, like this time that we're in right now compared to the other 98% of human existence. Like we're the weirdos in terms of like the span of humanity. And so what we've done essentially in this time are take things that we do naturally and made industries out of them that are based on material power. And so in, you know, so this might be a, I might get a little college dormy on you right quick. But the thing that I see is that we've taken this like ancient reality, this pre-modern reality of the people in the community that are able to reach into the world of meaning and pull something out and display it to us in a way that reminds us of the world of meaning and reminds us like what it means to be who we are. And not only what we do, but why we do and who we are and who we've been and what it means to be us and what it means to be together. And we've taken that and made it this completely immaterial thing. And we've reduced it to a material, buyable, sellable product where the only way we interact with it, it's all controlled by buying and selling, and it's always like a commodified thing. And so the people that control the material world are the people with the most material power. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we see, you know, I would also say that, I would also say we could look at that, that list about all, not only, and also this kind of like music industry reality as just a really one of domination of men and what men want. And you know, hyper masculine ways of being that aren't necessarily always being balanced by feminine ways of being, ways of knowing, you know, things that we're looking for, the things that we appreciate. But then also it's really dominated by whiteness too. And so we see, you know, the people that make those lists are the people typically that the white world appreciates. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you were to say, if you were to look at the people who actually create American music in particular, which is all music created by the children of African slaves without any exceptions, and say, well, like who does that community feel should be on the list? You know, so is Gil Scott-Heron going to end up on the list or not? He might not. You know, Robert Johnson may or may not be on the list. You know what I mean? But there are people that that community of musicians would put there that maybe the world might not. And I think it's a really similar reason why you see it being so dominated by men.
Excellent points. I mean, I agree with you right down the line. And it's, I think those are points that we all have to like really consider.
So we're near the end of the roundtable here. And one of the shows, Brother Ali, that stands out for you is Donny Hathaway. Where? Live where?
So I wasn't at this show. Donny Hathaway passed, like, I think when I was a little kid. But, you know, this is somebody that, like, I really feel like, you know, we reach through time. Like, his music, like, reaches through time and really has healed me in every stage of my life. And this particular show, there are two live records that he has, and I'm not sure which one it's from. But, you know, this is a Carole King song that he sang initially on the record, along with Roberta Flack, that we were kind of talking about off air before we started recording this conversation. But, you know, then he goes into this, it's in a little club. It seems like it's a black audience, and he starts playing You've Got a Friend. And it's really, really beautiful. It's a really stripped down kind of version of the song. But when they get to the chorus, without any prompting, without any coaching, the audience just takes over the chorus. And so he just kind of riffs along with them as if the audience is the choir. And the fact that it's You've Got a Friend in particular, you know, this particular recording of this particular song really summarizes all of the beauty in music in my mind.
Hey, thank you all for a great roundtable.